06-5023, United Pacific versus the United States. Mr. Wilson? And you're keeping 5 minutes for rebuttal, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. If it pleases the Court, I represent United Pacific, the surety in this construction case. And my main point today is that there are four cases, all decided by this Court, which should allow my client to proceed with its illegal contract claims. Godley, Amdahl, Insurance Company of the West, and the AT&T cases. Ours is a contract action where there's a clear illegality by the government and a violation of the public policy. So it's our contention that as a result, then the contract is declared illegal. It's a void ab initio and is then becomes an implied, in fact, contract allowing the quantum merit recovery.
But how is there any indication, Mr. Wilson, that the policy that's embodied in the statute was meant to in any way affect contractor rights? It really seems to be, when you look at it, purely related entirely to internal government allocation of funds and funding and authorization.
Well, the way I would get to that is I go back to the AT&T cases, and it says that if the statute does not invalidate the contract, then the court is supposed to undertake a public policy analysis. In our case, we clearly have public policy being violated, and that therefore you can use that public policy route to get to the point of it being declared void ab initio.
No, I understand that's the route you take, but I don't think by going through the analysis in this case, we found that the contractor was not entitled to have the contract declared void ab initio in the first, I guess, in the in-bank AT&T case, correct?
That's correct.
And it seems that a lot of the things that we said there with respect to the statute at issue there would apply here.
Now, well, if you give me a minute, I would like to distinguish that because I think they're wholly different. The statute in AT&T had overrun its contract $57 million on a fixed price contract, and they wanted to convert to a cost plus pursuant to that statute. Clever lawyering, but I don't see that there's really a public policy argument there. Ours is totally different. We have funding limitations that are prescribed for $300,000. You can't use maintenance funds to build a new building, as the government did here.
Well, how's that designed to protect the contract?
Well, I'm saying it's a public policy issue because they violated that.
So you agree that there's nothing in the statute that's designed to protect the contract?
But we don't need that because...
No, I understand.
We don't need that as our position.
But you agree that there isn't anything in the statute that's designed to protect the contract?
No, but in the statute for AT&T, it said there's no private right of action. That's not stated in our statute. Our statute, as I'm trying to distinguish, is very different, totally different, and starkly different.
But the statutes at issue here don't create a private right of action, do they?
Well, not the statute itself, but then you have to go to the public policy analysis under the AT&T holdings, and you have to go to the other cases I've cited, the Amdahl case, the Godley case, Insurance Company of the West. Insurance Company of the West is the case that deals with a surety, giving it the right to sue under the Tucker Act. The immunity issue is
yeah, but that not has nothing to do with whether the contract's void or not. I mean, all that says is you step into the shoes of the contractor.
Yeah, but Insurance Company of the West says there's two issues when a surety can assert its rights and sue the government. That's when it completes the project or finances completion. Well, that's what the surety did here. That's what United Pacific did.
The government may be arguing that you don't step into the shoes of the contractor, but that, if they are arguing that, seems completely wrong. I mean, you step into the shoes of the contractor. If the contractor can challenge the illegality, you can. But I think what we're suggesting to you is that the contractor couldn't challenge the illegality here.
Well, that may be, but that's not really necessary here because the surety came in after a termination of the contractor.
You have greater rights than the contractor has?
No, but we have the same contractual rights that the contractor would have had.
Sure.
Plus, we have a takeover agreement. So there were two contracts in play, which in effect both become void ab initio because of the actions of illegality by the government.
Well, that may be, but Insurance Company of the West doesn't tell us whether the contract gets voided or not. And the question is, how do you bring yourself under the in-bank AT&T decision?
Well, but because AT&T...
Or how do you escape from...
Well, I escaped from AT&T because the statutes are different. The statute, in our case, doesn't invalidate, so there has to be a public policy analysis. That's all I'm looking for from AT&T. But then you go to the cases like Godley and Amdahl, wherein, particularly in the Godley case, which I think is a pivotal case for us, there the government was able to void a fully completed contract because the illegality tainted the contract and there was a causal link. Well, in our case, we're arguing the same, that this illegality was so blatant and it was intentional. The government, we want to be able to prove, if we're able to go to trial on this issue, is that the government knew from day one what they were doing. But the surety didn't. The surety came in after the termination. The contractor didn't know about it either. The surety didn't know about it. Came in good faith and completed the project, spent $3.5 million completing the project, and then found out after the fact that it was an illegal contract. If it had been a legal contract, then that's what the surety's supposed to do, is come in and complete and pay that money to complete. But not in a situation where it was void ab initio from the very beginning. And the government tries to argue it both ways in their brief. They say that we should have asserted the illegality at the time of the bid, but we had no knowledge of that. And then yet in other parts of their brief, they're claiming that this was a legal contract. So they're all over the place as far as what's legal and what's not. From our standpoint, the illegality is crystal clear, and that it gives rise to the public policy analysis, and then that gives rise to the Amdahl and Godley analysis. And then you can't have it both ways. If the government can void a contract based on Godley, a fully completed contract, why should not the surety be allowed to do that? Especially when you go back to Insurance Company of the West.
Because the statute didn't give them the right to do it. That's the reason.
But our contention is you don't need that. Okay, the statute in AT&T, that's what I take away from AT&T. First, the main analysis of the AT&T statute doesn't apply. But the takeaway, I think it's head note 7, says that you then, if it doesn't address invalidation, and our statute doesn't, then you do the public policy analysis. And I think we have one of the clearest cases you could possibly have where they violated the public policy. Congress is supposed to authorize new construction around the country. In this case, they use maintenance funds.
Let me ask you, in AT&T, the AT&T court quoted with approval Longshore versus the United States, where it says, Congress has undoubted capacity to oversee the performance of executive branch agencies consistent with its constitutional authority. It's not for this court to instruct Congress on how to oversee and manage its creations. It cites another case. I mean, it seems to me that the statutes that are involved in this case, was it 2805 and 2811 of Title 10, fall within that statement?
I think they're much broader, because I think the public policy is so clearly violated, because Congress has put this lid, this limit, the ceiling on the government, so they don't spend money they're not supposed to spend.
Well, how does the result that you're seeking here assist in the enforcement of that public policy? Because you're saying the government still has to pay, you know, that if the contract is illegal, they've got to pay under
because it is illegal.
Quantum Merrill. I mean, how does that result help to enforce the policy of the statute or help to achieve the policy of the statute?
Because otherwise you're encouraging them to break the statute, to violate the statute, and use maintenance funds to, instead of repairing an air conditioner, they're building a building.
That may be the case, but aren't there other remedies for that? If government officials are violating procurement statutes, they can be disciplined appropriately. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, isn't that really another side of the house, so to speak?
Well, I agree with that, but the bedrock principle here is that it is illegal. The contract was illegal. That's what we want to be able to prove. It's void ab initio. It becomes an implied in fact contract. And a surety that comes into that circumstance, first, if they knew it was illegal, they wouldn't have issued the bond. If they had found out later after they issued the bond, they would have denied coverage when the termination occurred, saying this is illegal. And under Godley, I think they'd be successful in stating that they did not have to perform. But in this case, they didn't know.
How does it help the congressional objective that they limit the amount that the government can spend, and under your theory, the government's obligated for even more? How does that vindicate the public policy reflected in the statute?
Well, because in this specific case, the government committed fraud and there was illegality. So, yes, it punishes the government in this particular case, but
fraud?
The overall public policy is...
Fraud? What fraud?
The fraud was putting the contract out for bid, knowing that it was illegally funded and should not go forward.
It's an odd way of looking at it.
Mr. Wilson, you're into your rebuttal. We'll give you a full rebuttal time.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from the government. Mr. O'Connell.
May it please the court. My reading of the AT&T cases and the Godley case is a bit different than opposing counsel's. First of all, with respect to the purpose of the statutes at issue, as I think the trial court correctly pointed out here, United Pacific actually has a much weaker case here than the plaintiff did in the AT&T case, because the reason is that in the AT&T case, there was a connection between the purpose of the statute and what happened to the contractor. The statute was passed because Congress was concerned about the use of fixed price contracts for these research and development projects of the military. They used a fixed price contract and there were cost overruns. Here, Judge Firestone went at some lengths, looked at the legislative history and also the language of the statutes, found that there was nothing in either the statute itself or the legislative history which indicates some intention to benefit a surety or a contractor.
Well, what would happen here if the government, in the middle of contract performance, had said, whoops, we shouldn't have entered into this contract, it violates the statute, and we're not going to pay you any more money?
Well, there's actually, what would happen is that under the Air Force regulations, they would have to stop work on the contract and just get the contract funded.
So
properly.
The government could do this. The government could say, this contract violates this statute, we're stopping.
We're stopping it, and we'll get the money from the right source so that they can straighten out the funding issues.
Okay, so what we're really dealing with is a situation in which, in your view, the contract's voidable at the instance of the government, but not at the instance of the contract.
Well, I'm not saying it's voidable. All we're saying is that if the agency is taking the money from the wrong pot, you just go back and straighten it out so that you're getting the money from the correct
pot. Well, if they can't
pot.
Get the money from another pot, they could stop and say, oh, you know, we can't go forward with it.
You're saying that case would be a termination for convenience.
It would probably be a termination for convenience under those cases. And by the way, in a termination for convenience, obviously the contractor would be limited to the contract price minus what has already been paid and minus work not done. It wouldn't be entitled.
Why would it be a termination for convenience? Why can't the government just say this is an illegal contract, we're not going forward with it?
Well, in that case, you know, depending on how the hypothetical is framed, presumably the contractor would be paid for any work that it's done. So I don't see how there would be any harm to the...
Yeah. They could go in and assert a quantum merit claim under our cases. But your view is that the government could refuse to go forward with the contract and raise the illegality question, but that the contractor can't do that.
Well, the if it was a statute like it is here, where it's a statute designed...
I'm talking about this statute. Under this statute, the government could say, whoops, we made a mistake, we didn't have any authority to do this, we're not going to go forward with this contract, but that the contractor has no ability to raise that issue.
I believe that's correct, and I believe, in fact, Judge Schall wrote in the Cessna opinion that if it's a statute that's designed to benefit the government and not the private contractor, the private contractor cannot raise the illegality issue. Just turning to Godley for a moment, I believe that Godley also does strengthen the government's case as well, because what Godley says is that the record must show some causal link between the illegality and the contract provisions. Here, there's no contract provision which was affected by this alleged illegality. They didn't have to do any more work. They didn't have to do any less work. They didn't have to do work any differently. They didn't get paid at a different time. It was just strictly where the money came from. So here, even assuming that the contract was illegal, it didn't affect the contractor in any way because the contract remained the same. Nothing was different from the contractor's perspective. The contractor was treated completely the same here when the contract was funded from operations and maintenance funds as if it had been paid from another source of funds. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask the court to affirm the opinion of the Court of Federal Claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connell. Mr. Wilson?
On this issue of the government having certain rights, but the contractor or surety not having those rights, I think that's wrong, and I think that goes to the very basic premise of why we filed this appeal. And a case that I think is on point is National Surety versus U.S., which states that there must be consideration for the surety's rights. And in this case, there was no consideration. It's void from day one. They intentionally do what they've done, the government does, and they basically hoodwinked the contractor and then the surety out of millions of dollars. So the point
why
is...
Why do you say hoodwink? What's the evidence that the government did this on purpose?
Well, that's what would have to be presented at trial. But if you look at what it was
you have a fraud,
new construction.
Is there a fraud claim here?
Excuse me?
Is there a fraud claim here?
I think there's a misrepresentation claim and potentially a fraud claim if the evidence can be presented clearly.
Did you plead a fraud claim?
We pled fraudulent misrepresentation, yes.
Where do I find that?
I guess what you're saying, Mr. Wilson, that there was a fraudulent misrepresentation, in your view, to all prospective bidders. I mean, there was no fraud directed intentionally at your client. I mean, you're just saying because of this, what you say was this funding problem, the way the procurement was structured, that all the bidders were given the wrong scoop, right?
Well, But that's what we have to present, and that's going to be factually driven. But basically, they took an old World War II building and they turned it into a modern office building.
What I'm saying is, why is it necessary for you to prevail? Why do you have to allege fraud? I mean, if in fact a policy was violated that was meant to benefit in some way a contractor, the fact that the government had no fraudulent intent makes no difference.
I would agree with that as an alternative account. Our main thrust, our main claim is breach of contract.
But
this contract's void ab initio and implied in fact contract and quantum merit recovery.
I guess what I'm saying is that I'm maybe not saying it the right way, but I mean, even if there was fraud, if the statute, if the government employees or officials did intentionally go out of their way to violate these statutes by structuring this procurement, if we were to find, as the court below did, that this wasn't meant for the benefit of the contractor, these statutes, you still wouldn't win, even if there was fraud.
But then I go back to AT&T.
But that's
there has to be a public policy analysis.
Yeah, but I understand, but the point is you don't need to show fraud.
I agree with that. It's an alternative count. And I don't have the complaint right here,
but I
believe it's the last
count. It's there.
But breach of contract is our main action, and that's what we base this upon. And there, it's not just a contractor, because this contractor goes bankrupt shortly after being terminated. And that's part of the issue here also, is that if there hadn't been a bond, there wouldn't have been a loss at all. That it was only because of this whole situation with funding, legal funding, that this came about at all. Otherwise, they never would have been bonded, because they went bankrupt and didn't qualify for bonding shortly after this.
Does the Court of Federal Claims have jurisdiction over a fraud claim? Or does that come under the Tort Claims Act?
Probably more properly under the Tort Claim Act, but misrepresentation is also pled within that count. And we think clearly we'll be able to show misrepresentation. But I agree with Judge Shaw, we don't need that to recover. It's back to breach of contract.
Well, the question is, does it give you any better right to recover than the illegality theory?
Well, I think it's more in terms of if we go back to the trial court, that we'll be able to show how obvious it was, how blatant it was, and that they did violate, they have to take these approvals for a new construction to Congress, usually takes a year or two. So they were not only using maintenance funds they should have used to replace a bad air conditioner to build a whole new building, but then they circumvented Congress. And so that's why the bedrock here is that it's illegal, and a surety shouldn't have to perform and pay the money out that it normally would when the contract itself is illegal. The only other thing I would say is that government's counsel, in reference to Godley, there is an impact here, and it's what I was just referring to, that there never would have been a bond. If the surety had known there was an illegal contract, they never would have bonded the contractor. And if they would have found out, in the next couple of years before they came in to complete the work, they would have denied coverage under Godley and Amdahl in this series of cases. So, and I think then we would have won on that position.
Then there would have been a Miller Act issue.
Yes.
One way. It would have been settled.
Yes.
Yes.
Resolved Miller
in
Act
that setting.
This is a Miller Act bond, so yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And I guess I would end that I don't think the government can have it both ways. What we're arguing here is the bedrock principle of illegality should apply to the benefit of the surety. This is not where a surety just pays to perform. They do that all the time. This is where there was illegality, and there should be a recovery when that happens, particularly when it's so blatant and obvious as what the government did in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. The case is submitted.